Hello and welcome to The Other Marthas, the show where a drama student and a film graduate try to make sense of things we wish we were qualified in instead, with an emphasis on history, mystery and all things morbid. A quick disclaimer before we get started, we don't claim to be experts in any of the fields we'll be discussing, so while everything we say will be based on individual research, it's all a bit of fun and we suggest that you take everything we say with a pinch of salt. I'm Martha, I'm the drama student.
And I'm the other Martha, the film graduate.
So Martha, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, Martha, today we're talking about Amelia Earhart. And I'm really excited because she was so much fun to research.
I know some things about Amelia Earhart that I'm going to chip in with and you can't stop me.
Oh, great. Okay. So Amelia Earhart is best known for being the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic and also for the mystery that then kind of consumed her reputation in 1937. I like that she's still better known, I think anyway, for her flying achievement than for what happened to her later on. I think that's cool.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, like, if someone said Amelia Earhart to somebody who, like, knows things.
Pilot.
Yeah, they'd be like, oh yeah, she's that pilot. They wouldn't be like, oh yes, she's that mysterious
that
woman.
I'm not going to say anymore because I... to...
Crabs!
It wasn't crabs!
Crabs! Crabs! We'll get...
It's not crabs! Stop your crabby foreshadowing. Amelia Earhart was born on July 24th, 1897 in Atchison, Kansas. Earhart had a somewhat turbulent childhood. She moved a lot and her family intermittently struggled for money. Her dad, who worked on the railroad, was an alcoholic, but her mum was from a wealthy family and Amelia's early childhood was spent living with her maternal grandparents until she was 12. So she lived with them and also her younger sister Muriel. Don't we all? Well...
Poor old Muriel Earhart, who's like,
yeah, she got the...
nobody knows who I am. What did she do? Next episode, Muriel.
Well, quite a lot of Amelia's early life is she went here to visit her sister, and it's always a different place. So clearly her sister also moved around a lot, but I don't really know what she did.
Ooh.
So she, until she was 12, she attended a private school. She lived with her grandparents and also her sister Muriel. And then in 1909, the girls went to live with their parents in Des Moines in Iowa. Which is where she saw her first plane at a state fair. Supposedly, she wasn't very impressed at all by this plane. She called it a thing of rusty wire and wood, which looked not at all interesting. Yeah, I know.
I love that. I read this and I was like,
and this is where she first saw a plane. And I was like, wow, what did she think? She was really unimpressed. Her passion for flying wasn't going to truly awaken until a decade later when she attended a stunt flying exhibition. Now, supposedly, she went with a friend and they were just standing in this clearing. I'm not sure why. Maybe they didn't want to be seen seeing it. And one of the planes dove straight at her. She said, I'm sure the pilot, well, she said, I'm sure he, but meaning the pilot, said to himself, watch me make them scamper. And so just out of obstinacy, she stood her ground and was just like, yep, dive at me, do it. And she says, I did not understand it at the time, but I believe that little red airplane said something to me as it swished by. And the seeds of her love of aviation began there. She's a really good writer, by the way, so I'm glad we get a lot of little quotes from her in this.
Did she write a lovely book?
She wrote two lovely books.
Ooh, book club!
Yeah! Winding back a bit, Earhart's mother left her father in 1914. She took the children with her. And Amelia graduated from Hyde Park High School in 1915. Her yearbook quote was, A.E., the girl in brown who walks alone, which is, firstly, quite harsh.
Oh my
God! Secondly, like, really poetic. Like, can you imagine a bunch of 18-year-olds going, oh, yeah, so best hair, so most likely to end up in prison, lol, 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 lol. Oh, what should we do for Amelia? The girl in brown who walks alone. It's kind of creepy.
Question. What if she was choosing her own yearbook quote and, like, she's just, like, an angsty
teen? Power move.
Yeah,
whether it was her own yearbook quote or someone else chose it for her, she was described as the girl in brown who walks alone. The following year, her mother received an inheritance from her mother's estate, and she used it to send Amelia to Ogont School in Philadelphia, which is an exclusive high school and junior college. I don't know what she studied there, but she went there.
Aeroplanes?
No.
Oh.
During a visit to Toronto to see her sister during the Christmas break of her second year at Ogont's, Amelia saw an amputee for the first time. It was a wounded soldier returning from serving in World War I, and it had a very profound effect on Amelia. She refused to return to Ogont's, and instead she chose to become a volunteer nurse at a veterans hospital in Toronto, up until the armistice, which luckily was in November of that year. the experience solidified her stance as a lifelong pacifist. So after this, she went to go and live with her mother and her sister in Northampton, Massachusetts. They've moved for a while because her sister was now attending Smith College there. The reason she was in Toronto before was because she was at school. In 1919, Earhart entered Columbia University. She was studying pre-med, apparently. But she left after a year to rejoin her parents in LA, who had reconciled and they were living together again. Now, on December the 28th, 1920, a pilot called Frank Hawks gave her a ride in his plane. This was the first time Amelia had been up in the air, and her obsession with aviation truly begun in earnest here. She says of this experience, "By the time I had got 200 or 300 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly."
Well, so, either that or fall.
True. Now, aviation at the time, obviously, was a very male-dominated industry, but Earhart was undeterred. In one of the websites I read to get this biography, it has a little not like other girls paragraph where it's like, she always liked tree climbing and she would belly slam her sled to get it started. And she used to hunt rats with a .22 caliber rifle, which is hilarious and badass. But yeah, so there's that. She enjoys these masculine coded activities, I suppose.
But I suppose nowadays it's like, oh, I'm not like other girls. And it's like, okay, well, you're just wrong. But like at that time,
it was
like there probably weren't a lot of ladies.
Yeah, well, it's more, the point is more that it's outside of the norm for behavioral customs for girls.
Like Blackbeard cool. with his beard.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think a cool thing about Earhart is she makes it very clear her aim is not to go, I'm not like other women, I can do these things. Her aim is to do the things, then go, see, women can do those things. She kept a scrapbook of newspaper clippings of successful women in male-dominated fields. So there'd be film directors and producers, lawyers, mechanical engineers, successful figures in advertising and management, things like that. So Amelia had her first flying lesson on January the 3rd, 1921. It's all very quick. This whole thing sort of from her first flight to her becoming a pilot is like, wham!
I have two questions.
Yeah.
Number one, this is a statement. When trains were invented,
yeah,
they were like, oh, women can't go on trains because their wombs might fall out because really? They'll go too fast. So I wonder if there was any concern for Amelia's womb. Number two.
I doubt it at this point medically. I think they were just sexist.
Just thinking about medically now, a lot of womb emphasis
That's
on the womb.
That's true, actually. We were talking about this the other day. As a cis girl, when you go into GP surgeries with anything that's not like clearly nothing to do with anything, they'll probably be like, you're probably moody because of your period, and you're like, no, I think I've broken my foot, and they're like, it'll be those hormones, take the pill, and you're like, no, I've got a sty in my eye anyway.
Number two, was she rich?
Well, her mum was, but she keeps coming in and out of money, which does play into the following couple of years with her training,
because it's just kind of like, you know, if I was like, I want to learn how to fly a plane, I'm not going to be able to afford plane lessons. Start.
No, exactly. She at this point, I think she was in good money.
Okay.
It certainly seems that she had quite a privileged start in that sense, but it keeps kind of coming and going. So her first flying lesson is with a female pilot called Netta Snooks, which I really like that name.
Good name.
Yeah, it's a Burt Kinner's airfield in Los Angeles. And by December 15th that same year, she receives her license from the National Aeronautics Association. Madness.
Ooh.
Although I was going to say, I was like, 1 year? That's absurd. But then it occurred to me that we are talking about tiny single or dual seat planes. Nowadays, running an aircraft involves a lot of other things.
Well, yeah, also, like, one of my lecturers at uni flies planes, and he said that, like, you know, you have to get your license, and then you have to do hours in the plane to be able to, like, get approved to pass or something. He's like that, kind of like when you learn to drive a motorbike, like, you get your motorbike license, and then you just get hours, but you have to go by yourself because there's only one person on the bike. Don't quote me on that if you want to drive a motorbike. I wouldn't recommend it. Very bad.
Well, in a way... Yeah, in a way, I imagine it's probably easier and safer to do that with flying, just because you're not as likely to collide with someone else's plane, because there's more.
Yeah,
air.
If you're
it's not like the air is divided into lanes, and you're like, oh god, there's someone coming at me. Got to take a shot.
Also, well, it depends, because you know, you could land into a building, which isn't ideal.
Yeah. The dangers of actual flying are going to be greater, I guess, because you can crash. If you do nothing, you will die. Whereas if you
but
do
there
nothing,
is that statistic. There's more people die in road accidents than in plane crashes.
Yeah, which because, like, makes sense.
More people on the road than in the sky.
Exactly.
But anyway,
and even more so now.
It also depends like what she was doing, because if she was having a lesson every day, she's going to pick it up
fast.
Oh,
I doubt that. But
do you know what I mean? Like, because I think it took me just under a year to do my driving test, but that was like I had a break for uni and
was like
having
point,
one
actually.
Lesson
it's
a
more,
week.
It's,
and
it's
stuff.
A single pilot vehicle, so it's more similar to a car, I suppose, than to a commercial jet. Mm.
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't compare the two, I don't think.
No.
I feel like I could probably fly a plane.
I would absolutely love to fly a plane. Throughout this, I kept thinking of that scene in Sabriel where she has the paper wing and she can control it by whistling. It's really cool. Anyway, I'd love to
fly
in this
the first chapter
of
that trash.
Really?
Yeah, no, I'm joking. It's not trash. It just didn't appeal to me. Did you ever watch... It was like a little old woman with a dog and she had a spotty plane. It was called, like, come outside or go outside or something. Aww. I was obsessed with it. And she just gets in her plane with her dog and goes on a little adventure.
I would love to do that.
Goals. Can I be the little dog, please?
Sure. So she's got her license from the NAA and she very quickly buys her own plane, also in 1922. That's thanks to she's working multiple part-time jobs at this point and also some help from her mother. The plane was a second-hand Kinner Airster. It's a two-seater biplane, and it was painted bright yellow, so she called it Canary, which is cute.
Oh my gosh, that's so fun.
Isn't it? She promptly used it to earn her first women's record by rising in it to a height of 14,000 feet. This was still in 1922. She basically bought the plane and then went, right, I'm going to go as high as I can, and broke a record. Cool. Good going, Amelia. So, 1924. Amelia's parents have separated again.
Drama.
So with the finances dwindling, Amelia had to sell Canary, which is sad. She used the proceeds to buy a car with which she drove her mother to Boston, where her sister Muriel was now.
Probably would have been easier to make that journey in a plane.
I was gonna say, just fly your mum over. It is a biplane. Hold on, how many seats did I say? I think it's two seats.
Two.
Yeah. God damn it, Amelia, what were you thinking? Amelia re-enrolled at Columbia University at this point, but she had to drop out again after a year because of lack of funds. So she moved back to Boston and she became a social worker for a while at Denison House, which was a settlement home for immigrants. She joined the NAA again and she continued flying in her spare time, participating in air shows whenever she could. Meanwhile, in 1927, American pilot Charles Lindbergh made history by becoming the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic. The media loved this, and one of the prominent personalities to pick up the story was George Palmer Putnam. He was a leading publisher of art books and also other books. He published a lot of greats, books like Edgar Allan Poe, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and Thomas Carlyle, among others. And it was Putnam who approached Lindbergh to edit and publish his book, We. W-H-E-E, which also would have worked, but his book is called We. It's his autobiography and the story of his groundbreaking flight. The title refers to his relationship with his plane, which I think is quite cute. Martha looks absolutely disgusted. I think it's really nice.
I'm sneering at that.
Why are you sneering?
Because I mean, I get it, because it's like the thing that, you know, supports you. Like, without it, if you were that high in the sky, you would die for sure. But it's just kind of like, I could do that for anything. Like, oh, I'm going to write a book about my relationship with my laptop and I'm going to call it We.
No, but I feel like you have special relationships with, like, your archery bows and your plants and stuff. There are things that you use that have more sentimental value. I have a relationship with my violin that's different to other objects that I own. I think it's cool.
I'm just pooping on it for fun.
So Putnam wanted to capitalize further on the success of We, and he started putting out feelers. So in 1928, Amelia Earhart received a call at work saying something along the lines of, "Hi, Amelia, do you want to become the first woman to fly the Atlantic?" And apparently she said, "I'm too busy to answer just now," because she thought it was a prank. And then they quickly explained and gave a lot of references. She realized it was genuine and then immediately was like, "Oh my God, yes, of course." Now, supposedly she was chosen for her flying experience, education, and ladylike appearance. I'm not sure what I mean by
that. Yes, I've heard though that she was pretty, but that she was very tall and quite masculine.
Yes. So there's another speculation which I really like, that she looked a lot like Charles Lindbergh, who was the guy who'd flown already across the Atlantic, and they were like, oh great, female equivalent. I think that's not what happened, but I find it quite funny that people speculated it.
I do also know that she wore a big shoe size and would wear men's shoes.
Yeah. So on June 17th, 1928, Earhart left Trespassy Harbour. Earhart left Trepassey Harbour, Newfoundland, in a plane called a Fokker F7. Ooh. Need to say that very clearly. It was named Friendship, and she was accompanied by pilot Bill Stultz and co-pilot Slim Gordon. The trio arrived triumphant at Burryport in Wales approximately 21 hours later, and they made worldwide headlines. And when they returned to the US, they were greeted by a ticker tape parade. I had to look up what a ticker tape parade was, but it's basically when the parade route is lined by buildings so people can lean out their windows and throw confetti, which is fun. And there was a reception held by President Calvin Coolidge at the White House for them, all very lovely. You look mystified.
Did they like wee in bottles?
Oh, of the 21... God, that's a good point. I don't know, maybe they just held it, because I would imagine... You can't really scramble, and like, you can't put your bum over the edge.
I do think like pilots have special funnels that go into bottles.
I actually wonder if they wore essentially catheters, because
you wouldn't want to be catheterized just for a holiday.
No, not actual not inserted, but I can imagine. I'd never thought of that, but.
Whenever anyone tells me that they've done something for like 21 hours, I'm like, where was your wee going?
It's a really good point. If you know...
if you know where Amelia Earhart weed, please let us know.
Despite her newfound fame, she was now acclaimed worldwide. Amelia was kind of frustrated by the experience in some respects, because she hadn't actually got to touch the controls at all. She was just kind of a passenger. Ugh. And
I'm not having that. I'm not having it.
Yeah, I know. So the whole record was kind of duff, and that was annoying to her because she was a good pilot. She said she felt a bit like a sack of potatoes, but she did write a book about it.
So she might well have not been there.
Yeah, like, exactly.
They might well have just taken a uterus. You know, at the time, they will have just defined that as a lady part, and they will have just put a uterus on ice and been like, a woman came with us.
Well, it probably would have been the first uterus on ice to cross the Atlantic, but it wouldn't have made it to the headline. Not as photogenic.
That's what they're using her for.
Yeah, basically. It was. She was just there for the publicity, which was frustrating to her.
I could have sat in that plane.
Yes, you could.
Weed in a bottle.
Yeah, but she did still write a book about it. However, it did mean this fame that Amelia was now free to pursue flying full time. So she entered her first pro race in 1929. She placed third. It was the Cleveland Women's Air Derby, which Will Rogers nicknamed the Powder Puff Derby because he was a tit, I guess. Which also, it made me think of your Lady Inches story, Martha.
Lady
if you want
inches.
To give that a brief overview.
Yeah, so basically, I've got big shoulders. I'm hench, what can I say? That's how the story starts. Hmm. I was doing the costume for a short film, and we were buying suits. One of the actors has 38-inch shoulders, so also do I. The actor wasn't there, who's a man. And so I was like, well, I've got the same shoulders as him. I'll try it on, make sure it fits. So that I tried it on, it fitted. I told a boy at uni this story, and he was like, well, I've only got 36-inch shoulders. And I was like, okay. And he was like, so... what do you mean you've got 38-inch shoulders? And I was like, I've got big shoulders. And he said, well, girl inches, which I don't know how to express to you the fact that inches is just a measurement, that like it's a universal measurement that everybody understands as a thing. Girl inches.
It says the girl inch shoulders, and the Powder Puff Derby reminded me of
band
women.
Name.
Or...
Girl inch shoulders.
Or the Powder Puff Derby, actually. That would be pretty
both.
Badass.
Let's make rival bands.
Yeah, okay, done. So yeah, she starts flying professionally, basically, full time. During this time, George Putnam becomes Earhart's manager, and he arranges all of her flying engagements and also her interviews for maximum publicity. She does a lot of interviews. and the two also strike up a romance. So they're married on February the 7th, 1931. But Amelia Earhart is very specific about how she refers to the marriage. She says it's a partnership with dual control, and she keeps her maiden name because she's very cool.
How old is she at this point?
1931, so 34.
Oh, okay. No, I was just wondering. 34-year-old lady.
Check out our new hit single, 34-year-old lady, coming soon to the other month.
By Girl in Shoulders.
Girl in Shoulders. I'll have to do a rival jingle later on.
Well, mine's just, I've just stole that off Jenna Marbles. It's not.
Oh, really?
It's actually a cover.
That's another.
Girl in Shoulders is a cover band. So
at this time, reports were starting to grow that Earhart was basically a kind of publicity puppet for her husband Putnam, and her airmanship was actually subpar, which was upsetting because that's what she wanted to be known for, and she was good at it. So she set out to prove them wrong. So first she pilots a tiny single engine Lockheed Electra from Newfoundland to Ireland, and then on May 20th, 1932, she becomes the first woman ever to fly solo across the Atlantic. She starts in Newfoundland, and she's supposed to finish in Paris. But in fact, a combination of strong north winds, icy conditions, and mechanical problems force her to land in a pasture near Londonderry in Northern Ireland. And she says, after scaring most of the cows in the neighbourhood, I pulled up in a farmer's backyard. The flight had taken 14 hours and 56 minutes, which is 6 hours less than her flight in 1928 with the lads piloting her, and set her most famous world record.
Also, oh my God, my voice! Also, if she'd have gone to Paris, she would also have done the Channel as well.
Oh, true. I imagine, I don't know actually, but I imagine the Channel would have been done by then because it's tiny, but it would have been something else for her to do. True.
Just another one off the list.
Another one off the list. Coming soon to the Powderpuff Derby. Watch this space. The endearing details of her landing only sort of enhanced her reputation. Her renown increased both in the US and overseas, and President Herbert Hoover presented her with a gold medal from the National Geographic Society. Congress awarded her the first ever Distinguished Flying Cross presented to a woman. And at the ceremony, Vice President Charles Curtis praised her heroic courage and skill as a navigator at the risk of her life. Now, a little bit of foreshadowing, to me that quote is a little bit haunting in retrospect, but nonetheless a very worthy piece of praise. So, for Earhart, the flight meant something a bit more profound. She says, this proved that men and women were equally skilled in jobs requiring intelligence, coordination, speed, coolness, and willpower.
Coolness.
This is one of the things, as I alluded to earlier, that I really like about her, is that she uses her victories to prove that larger groups are capable of doing things, as opposed to prove that she's special and stands out from those groups. I really like that.
Yeah. Good way to do things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in 1932, she published her second book called For the Fun of It, her first book, as mentioned previously.
Oh, yes, I've heard of this.
Yeah, I really want to read it now because she's a great writer from what I've seen. But her first book in 1928 was called 20 Hours, 40 Minutes After the First Groundbreaking Flight. But this one presumably is, you know, better because she did stuff. Anyway, from here, I have a brief overview of the records that she set from 1931. So in 1931, she attained the highest altitude in an autogyro, an autogyro being just a very basic plane. I've not put when this is, but at some point she also became the first person to fly an autogyro across the US and back. In 1932, she piloted the fastest transcontinental flight by a woman. In 1933, she did the same again and broke her own record. In 1935, she became the first person to fly solo across the Pacific from Hawaii to California, which is even more miles than the transatlantic flight. In 1935, again, she became the first person to fly solo from Los Angeles to Mexico City. In 1937, I think, she piloted the fastest non-stop flight from LA to Mexico City to Newark, New Jersey. And in 1937, again, she piloted the fastest east to west crossing from Oakland, California to Honolulu, Hawaii. So she didn't just break that one world record. She set a lot of records.
I'm not here to poo-poo Amelia at all. Love her. But at a time where plane, you know, one or two person planes are relatively new in development and things.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of records to break.
Yeah, it's kind of like first woman to get in a plane. Not that she well was, done. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, some of them...
Yeah, for sure. A lot of these were quite inaugural attempts, and therefore it's more likely that she would set a record. But I think...
Still cool, though. But it's a bit absolutely. Like, you know, when someone wants to get into the Guinness Book of Records, and so
they're like... Oh, I balanced the most Tic Tacs on my nose while sitting under a gazebo with a parrot saying Pretty Polly in my ear. It's like, okay, well, you're the only person to have ever done that, though.
It's so weird that, of course, no one has attempted that. Not that this is, and it's still a good achievement, but, you know, it's just...
Yeah, no, that's a good point, though. But I think, I don't know, but I feel like a lot of the things she did were less, again, in order to prove herself the best, but more just to make new strides in aviation. So a lot of them, while she probably did set out to make or break records, were also just about, oh, no one's done this before. This is so cool. Let's give it a go and prove that people can do it. And so she sort of set up a lot of new things as well. Her other achievements included founding a clothing line, a functional clothing line, for the woman who lives actively in 1935, which I quite like. She also became the aviation advisor and women's career counsellor at Purdue University in 1935, which also haunts me because Purdue is the feminine of lost in French, foreshadowing. And at some point, she was also awarded the Cross of the French Legion of Honour, but I have no idea when or why. So if you do, feel free to let us know. A fun little anecdote about her 1935 Pacific flight from Honolulu to Oakland. She was getting kind of cold because she was in the air for a long time, obviously. So she unpacked a thermos of hot chocolate and enjoyed it in midair. She called it the most interesting cup of hot chocolate I have ever had, sitting up 8,000 feet over the middle of the Pacific Ocean, quite alone, which I thought was
first
very sweet.
Person to drink hot chocolate 8,000 feet above the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, that's such a cool record. Maybe she wasn't, though. Maybe someone had done that before, but they'd just kind of like gone up and then come back down. Another little anecdote. Upon the arrival of her Mexico City to Newark flight, she was met by a mob of fans, and she says, "I was rescued from my plane by Husky policemen, one of whom, in the ensuing melee, took possession of my right arm and another of my left leg. The arm holder started to go one way, while he who clasped my leg set out in the opposite direction. The result provided the victim with a fleeting taste of the tortures of the rack. But at that, it was fine to be home again." I really like that. She has such a cool sense of humour. Now we come to Earhart's final flight and the mystery that surrounds what happened next, which there's been a lot of foreshadowing for. Crabs, Purdue, what may have happened?
Crabs!
So, on May 21st, 1937, Earhart, along with her friend and navigator Fred Noonan, set out to make Amelia the first woman to fly around the world. Very cool. An earlier attempt in March had left Amelia's plane severely damaged. She set off from Honolulu, Hawaii, I believe, and basically immediately crashed due to weather conditions. But she insisted on having it rebuilt for a second attempt. She said, "I have a feeling that there is just about one more good flight left in my system, and I hope this trip is it." So, the repairs and delay did slightly alter Earhart's plans. First of all, instead of flying west, as was the initial plan, she was now going to travel east in hopes of avoiding bad weather. On the flip side, this would also put the most challenging leg of the journey at the end rather than the beginning. That leg being the flight to Howland Island from, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Lai, New Guinea, L-A-E, Lai, Lai.
I'll know.
Yeah, but hey, New Guinea. In the initial March attempt, the flying pair had been joined by another navigator called Henry Manning. He was really adept at wireless code, but Manning left the crew for this second attempt, prompting Earhart to dump her CW transmitter and trailing antenna, because she said these would just be a dead weight now, because neither she nor Noonan was very good at that kind of transmission. So she just dumped all the equipment. This meant that the pair would have to communicate exclusively by voice at higher bandwidths rather than using Morse code at lower bandwidths, which is what most stations would have been receiving.
I thought when you said at higher bandwidths, I thought you meant frequency. And so they're both like on the radio, like,
"Hey, we just did." That would have made the best tragicomedy. Earhart was pretty confident in her remaining navigator, though. Noonan did have a reputation as quite a heavy drinker, but he was a top-notch navigator, so she felt pretty safe in his hands. The team made good headway initially for much of their journey. They successfully landed in Brazil, Dakar, Khartoum, Bangkok, and Australia, among other destinations. And their penultimate leg took them to Lai, New Guinea, where they touched down on June 29th. And the next day, Amelia sent her husband a telegram which said, "Radio misunderstanding and personal unfitness probably will hold one day." This was somewhat unusual, just given that Amelia was pretty keen to continue her journey as quickly as possible, but she'd also mentioned personal problems on the phone to her husband earlier. She never detailed what the problems were. It's speculated that Noonan might have been drinking, but that is pure speculation. It could have been anything else. Regardless,
can I just say something?
Yeah,
he probably reminded her of her dad.
Yeah, I thought that when I wrote it as well. I have no idea how that may or may not have affected her, but yeah, it's unfortunate. Don't come for Noonan, guys. We have no idea who's drinking or not, is the point.
This is all just speculation, everybody. It's all alleged. We don't want to send any hate in Noonan's direction, so please don't get online and send any hate to Noonan, because that's not what this is here for. It's just for conversation, just speculation.
Just our opinion, guys.
We're a history drama channel.
Yeah. Anyway, the problems, whatever they may have been, didn't hold the pair for too
allegedly
long. And at, well, one website said 10 a.m., but then the timeline that it gave didn't work with this. So I think it was 12:30 p.m. on July the 2nd, 2 days before Earhart's 40th birthday. They set off on the final leg of their journey. So the plan was for the Coast Guard cutter Itasca to guide Earhart's plane to Howland Island. But coordination hadn't been the smoothest with this, and some of the ship's communications were on bandwidths which Earhart couldn't receive because, as you'll recall, she dumped her CW transmitter in the sea. To
well,
remedy
she
this,
didn't know how to use it, though.
Yeah, know, no, she fair. Didn't. And also, like, I'm not a pilot. I'm sure she knew what she was doing more than I would, but she did nonetheless dump that transmitter. So to remedy this, a radio direction finder had been set up on Howland to work with the higher bandwidths that Earhart's plane was using. But this required batteries, and by the time they entered the area, the batteries had drained down. Why they weren't recharging the batteries or putting new batteries in, I don't know, but apparently that's
or conserving the battery power.
Well, yeah, just don't turn the thing on until she goes, "Hi, I think I'm close." Again, I don't know how these things work, and I'm sure people were doing their jobs as well as they could. 14 hours and 15 minutes into the flight, the Itasca receives the first in a series of quite garbled transmissions from Earhart, which mentioned cloudy weather, which was slightly confusing because the weather around Highland Island was very clear at the time. Later, the messages themselves became clearer, but the content remained quite concerning. One message came through saying, "We are circling but cannot see island, cannot hear you." It seems that the aircraft only received one message from the Itasca, though the ship had been trying to make contact for several hours. And the radio strength of Earhart's communications indicated that she was really close to the Itasca and the island, but apparently she couldn't see it and she couldn't hear them. As I say, the weather around Highland at the time was clear, but there was a cloud bank about 30 miles northwest, which may have prevented Noonan from taking the sightings he would need to navigate precisely. Plus, the charts he was using were apparently a few miles off. I don't know why, but apparently that was also a factor. At 7:42 a.m., the Itasca picks up the message, "We must be on you, but we cannot see you. Fuel is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 meters." And then 20 hours and 14 minutes into the flight, at 8:45 a.m. on July 3rd, Amelia Earhart sent a broadcast saying, "Running north and south," apparently in an attempt to reach the island or see anything. That would be the last communication that anyone would receive from Earhart or Noonan, and their plane was never seen again.
Allegedly.
So, well, no, the plane was never seen again.
No, not about that, about the communications.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, a rescue attempt was mobilised immediately. It would become the most extensive search of air and sea in naval history thus far. However, on July 19th, having spent $4 million and scoured 250,000 square miles of ocean, the US government were forced to call off the search, which is fair enough. They did a lot of looking. So what happened? The official party line, and probably the most likely explanation, is that the plane ran out of fuel and crashed into the sea.
Sounds likely.
Yeah. Obviously, we know that they didn't know where they were. We know that they were running low on fuel. It's the obvious explanation. The search didn't yield any results, which cast some doubt on it, but the fact that we don't know where the plane was when it disappeared and that it took, obviously, a fair bit of time to get the search ships into position to start searching made it quite possible that either the
and
plane went down.
And it's the sea.
Yeah, either the plane went down outside the search location or it would have just been swallowed by the sea by the time the search could begin. However, there is a second theory which posits that Earhart and Noonan managed to land on Gardner Island, which is now called Nikumaroro, sorry if I'm massacring that pronunciation, approximately 350 nautical miles south of Howland. In 1992, a small expedition found a shoe and a metal plate on the island. I believe it was a man's shoe, which comes into play with the whole thing about Amelia Earhart wearing man's shoes, so it doesn't necessarily mean it's not hers. And then in 1940, a skull and other bones were found there, though they were lost again before they could be tested. At the time of finding, the bones were thought to be those of a stocky, middle-aged man, but some experts now believe them to be Earhart's. I'm not sure why they skipped over Noonan, who is presumably more likely to have the bones of a stocky, middle-aged man than Amelia, but, you know, it could have been her, apparently. And the International Group for Historical Aircraft Recovery has since sent forensic dogs to Nikumaroro to try and locate further remains, but as far as I know, none have yet been found. It's thought that Earhart and Noonan could have survived for several days or even weeks on the island eating coral. However, this theory seems to raise more questions than it answers, really. Where's the plane? Whether they landed successfully or crashed nearby and washed ashore? At least a lot of debris from the plane would surely be on the island, if not the plane itself. So where did that get to? Where are the other bones? Some people think they may have been eaten by crabs, washed away, la la la. But it remains very much in question. And also, why didn't the 1922 hunt find the bones that were there, apparently, in 1940? I know there is some more about this. I've heard somewhere before possible radio transmissions coming from near the area and things like that. But I'm sure Martha will tell me more about that, if that's the case. In my opinion, the tragic disappearance of Fred Noonan and Amelia Earhart is probably just their plane crashed into the sea due to lack of fuel and sank before the rescue mission could arrive. Evidence clearly suggests they were low on fuel. They were unable to see anything outside the cloud bank they were stuck in. They would have been flying very low, given their last broadcast said they were at 1,000 feet, and I can only imagine they would not have tried to fly higher. Their fuel was running low. Therefore, I guess they would have been less likely to crash with shattering impact, and so there'd be less loose debris to potentially float towards the rescue mission and give indication of their fate. But whatever happened that day, Amelia Earhart will forever be remembered as a feminist icon and a pioneer of aviation. In a letter to her husband before she died, obviously, Earhart said...
Yes, it was.
Earhart said, "Please know I'm quite aware of the hazards. I want to do it because I want to do it. Women must try to do things as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others." Which is lovely, and that's exactly what happened. In 1997, on what would have been Earhart's 100th birthday, a female pilot called Linda Finch recreated Earhart's route around the world in tribute to her and successfully completed the voyage. So,
Finch?
Yeah?
Wait, so her name's Earhart, which is obviously like, it's spelled Earhart, but it's like, oh, Earhart.
And then Finch. That's true.
Finch is a little bird. It's cute.
That's really cute. That is cute. So, yeah, while Amelia's death was obviously a great tragedy, her life was a cause for great celebration. And I think it's clear that her goal was never to always succeed and always get places safely. It was to keep trying and keep inspiring others to do the same. And in that, I think she's succeeded beyond measure. So that's my little end of the story. Tell me about the crowds.
Well, that is lovely. First of all, I want to just quickly say, generally in cases where people go missing, sometimes, like, for example, the Dyatlov Pass, which update on the Dyatlov Pass, people think it's solved. I'd care to disagree. But like with the Dyatlov Pass, it's like, okay, well, it's clear that some of these deaths were hypothermia. Or like in Everest, we spoke about some of the deaths on Everest. It's like your body cannot sustain your life because of the conditions you're in. And so often they kind of drowse away.
Yeah.
But with Amelia Earhart and this other fella, if they did crash into the ocean and they just gently landed on the ocean and then sank, the whole time that they're sinking, they know they're going to die.
Yeah, I'm sure they would have tried to swim or create a raft or something.
I know, but it's, I feel like in a way it's kind of worse than ones
where I see what you're saying.
People are like a bit delirious or something's happened where they aren't fully aware of the situation. Whereas, like, in this case, unless that guy's very drunk, they're aware of the situation.
Yeah, but there's not a lot they can do because it's like, I'm sending radio broadcasts, but I don't know where I am and they're not getting to.
Oh, yeah. So about the radio broadcasts, I've read a few things about the fact that there's evidence that Amelia Earhart was alive for days after and was sending radio broadcasts saying where she was, but they thought it was a hoax, the people receiving them. Wow. So they didn't do anything about it. And she was there like, I'm right here. And everyone was like, it's not her.
I remember, I think it was a video I saw that mentioned broadcasts coming from the area not being picked up that may or may not have been Amelia Earhart. But I really, really doubt, given that the US was willing to spend $4 million on dredging the sea, not dredging the sea, but like scouring the sea and air for 250,000 square miles, that they would not have thought to check out a message apparently from Amelia Earhart saying, I'm here.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people that at the time, you know, there were hobbyist radio operators. And so... Yeah. It wasn't like the American government listening for signals. It's like Doug in his house, like
hearing
distress calls from a woman saying, I'm Amelia Earhart, I'm going to die, I'm right here, and going, no, and just ignoring it. So it might not have been the
case. It might not have been reported in time to anyone who could have done anything about it necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I don't know whether that's worse or better if she was briefly in a situation like the island thing. If it's like they're briefly in a situation where they're kind of safe for now, but at some point, unless someone intervenes, they will die just of lack of resources or exposure.
Here, I found this article, quote from this man, Amelia Earhart did not simply vanish July 2nd. Radio distress calls believed to have been sent from the missing plane dominated the headlines and drove much of the US Coast Guard and Navy search. Mm. When the search failed, all of the reported post-loss radio signals were categorically dismissed as bogus and have been largely ignored ever since. That's from Rick Gillespie talking about these transmissions. So it was after they had called off the search.
Oh wow.
That she was still sending messages.
I couldn't find it in her biographies on any official sites, which makes me think it's kind of speculation. But I don't know.
I thought obviously. You meant autobiographies. Well, this is from 2 years ago. Apparently there's been some analysis of them. Obviously, I can't just like sit and read a whole article and tell you about it, but it's interesting that it could have been the case that there were.
Yeah, for sure.
Some. And then the second thing I want to tell you about is because I kind of thought my gathering from what I've absorbed about Amelia Earhart, my thought was that they did land on this island and that they lived there for a bit or crashed and nearby and was washed up.
Yeah.
And the theory is that coconut crabs ate Earhart. Now, coconut crabs, if you don't know them, please look them up. They are horrifying. They are massive and they're so creepy. And they have been known to like steal little creatures and possessions and things to devour them. So, and they can climb trees. I hate it. Oh, God, I hate coconut crabs.
Isn't it the reason they're called coconut crabs is because they will get like half a coconut and pop it on their head and sometimes get the other half of the coconut, hide inside. I genuinely think
a coconut octopus.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, there's an octopus that will gather coconut shells and put it together. It like holds it in its suckers and puts it
and
together.
And then burst out like, surprise! Octopus coconut.
Coconut crabs are called coconut crabs because they look a bit like coconuts, probably for camouflage, but because they can climb the trees and they eat the coconuts.
Gosh, fair. Yeah, but they also I feel like
aviator women.
Maybe. Yeah, I think I've seen a YouTube video that goes into both of those things because I remember I vaguely heard them and I was interested in them. But then when I was looking up biographies and more official looking sources, I couldn't find anything. But that's made me interested again. So, hey, maybe there'll be an update in another episode. Who can say?
Maybe in biographies, though, they don't want to include like speculation. They just want to include like the facts that they have.
Yeah.
But like... it does look interesting, these theories. So I don't know. I feel like it's plausible that people would, especially if it is just hobbyist radio operators who were told to ignore
yeah.
any further transmission or weren't aware of the situation.
Yeah, but you also, I mean, just you would think that a search on that scale would have yielded something, and also that during the search that Amelia Earhart would have been broadcasting if she was alive, and that they would have picked it up.
But I also wonder,
that long for her to repair things and she was outside of the search range, I suppose.
Yeah, if she was outside of the search, like, did you say it was $4 million?
$4 million. The search range was 250,000 square miles, I think.
Right. I just think if she's like outside of it, or if they crashed on an island and they're just like searching the ocean and stuff, then I don't know. Like, it could be plausible that she washed up on a different island or landed near somewhere else that they missed. They were radio signals received by government agencies and so-called accidental witnesses. Just random people. And there are 57 transmissions that they think could have credibly come from Earhart and Noonan.
God.
So.
Oh, that's so nasty. Well, I can't, I hope they didn't, because nothing came of it. So I don't know. I'd prefer that they just.
Sorry, I'm so interested in this. Like, if you just want to cut all of it, it's fine. But here, this is now on treehugger.com. I know, I'm sure it's very credible, but it says here that officials that were searching for Earhart adamantly concluded that the plane had crashed into the water and sank, and therefore said that all other communications were labelled as all probably criminally false. So they just decided for themselves, like, this is the case, and then ignored everything else.
Yeah, that is weird.
I mean, who are you going to believe? Some lovely people who want to find some aircrafts, or the American government?
Who spent $4 million on it, though?
Well, $4 million to the American government's not a lot.
Actually, that's true. That's not that much, is it?
It's not that much to them, I'm just saying. Ooh, I found this part in this little article. July 2nd, Mabel Larimore in Amarillo, Texas, got a plane down on an uncharted island, small, uninhabited, said that Fred Noonan was seriously injured. And then later, Nina Paxton in Ashland, Kentucky, heard Earhart's radio call sign, which I think is fun to say anyway, which is K-H-A-Q-Q, down in ocean, on or near Little Island, at a point near, and then a gap, our plane out of gas, water all around, very dark.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah. But in some ways, I do wonder if it's, here's the thing, if they are trying to signal to the people to help them navigate, they can't, they sink, they crash into the ocean, they drown in that instance. It's like horrible. But they're like, well, we sort of die quickly. If they land near the island, they get onto the land, then they have the hope of someone could find us, and they're like calling for help over and over
and just losing hope.
July 7th, 1:30 a.m. Thelma Lovelace at St John's, New Brunswick, Canada. Interesting that so far all of these radio operators are women. We get, can you read me, can you read me, this is Amelia Earhart, please come in. We have taken in water. My navigator is badly hurt. We are in need of medical care and must have help. We can't hold on much longer.
Ouch.
So anyway, I do think it's interesting to look into the theories as well, because...
Oh, absolutely. You know, I would have looked into them had I known they were out there, but none of the websites I looked at.
They lied to you.
Yeah, but that's really interesting. Thank you for drawing those to my attention.
Oh, that is all right.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because there's just no way of knowing if they're credible or not, because it could absolutely be true, or it could absolutely be some people wanting a bit of fame and you just don't know.
It could be, because also if it's known that KKH was her code, and the people of America know that the US government's searching for her, I'm sure that there will have been people being like, I'm Amelia Earhart and I'm drowning.
Exactly. Whereas if it's not disclosed, then it's like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. But it's interesting. And also what I found interesting, so thank you for sharing, was more details about her life, because
I know
a lot about the mystery surrounding the end of her life and not a lot about all of the achievements that she had.
Exactly. I found the same. And I just think she seemed like such a cool, incredibly driven, very not relentlessly positive, but just uncowable person.
Yeah.
In a way that's really, really inspiring. I really like that.
Tenacious. You're
like an absolutely lovely lady. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tenacious is a good word for it. So yeah, that was Amelia Earhart, plus a lot of new theories that I'm really frustrated that I didn't find in my research. But I'm also glad that we focused a bit more on her life, because I think that's the bit that she would probably want us to focus on. I don't know her.
No, she's probably like, her ghost is probably like, no, find my bones.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for telling me about Amelia Earhart's life.
You're very welcome.
I'm glad to know more than she was eaten by coconut crabs. Please do Google them. They are horrifying.
Yeah, I bet. I might not, for my own peace of mind.
You shouldn't, but everybody else should.
There we are.
Thank you for listening to the Other Marthas podcast, the show where a drama student and a film graduate talk about things we have no business knowing about. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do subscribe or follow our podcast on all the various sites, and also give us a little like, a little review, whatever you want to do. Do it. Bye.